What does the invention of paper money in Europe have to do with the future of cryptocurrency? Stay tuned to this podcast to explore the connection.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. His name is Francis Greenberger. He is perhaps best known for popularizing the idea of the cooperative as opposed to the condominium in residential real estate development. This is a really fascinating conversation. If you're at all interested in real estate development, how projects move forward, some of the challenges in dealing with the market cycle and credit availability, and pretty much anything related to what could throw plans off for building a big building, you're going to find this conversation to be absolutely fascinating. So with no further ado, my conversation with Francis Greenberger. My special guest today is Francis Greenberger. He is a real estate developer, an author, a former literary agent, and a philanthropist. He is the founder of Time Equities, one of the larger real estate developers here in Manhattan and New York City. Perhaps he is best known as the creator of the residential co-op. His autobiography is Risk Game, Self-Portrait of an Entrepreneur. Francis Greenberger, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks, Barry.
So I'm kind of fascinated by your background and your history, and we're going to get into a lot of the details, but the obvious question, what sparked your interest in real estate coming from a background working in the book business?
It was pretty intuitive. I remember to this day, I was walking down the streets, looking at buildings, looking at architecture, thinking about built environments and thinking about real estate in New York, and realized that I had some sort of a visceral connection with it defied my background or any particularly logical connection with my past.
So in your book, Risk Game, you wrote something that stayed with me. Quote, the real estate industry has created far more bankruptcies than billionaires, unquote. Explain that.
Well, I think if you look around New York, and I was walking here past, for instance, Harry Macklow's gallery on Park Avenue, you know, Harry, who I know, has had a mixed career. He's had some incredible successes, but he's had some incredible failures, all in New York City real estate. So it's about timing. It's about risks. And it's about what you choose to do or not do.
So let's talk a little bit about timing and risks. You bought a piece of land down at 50 West Street back in the 1980s with the plan to either develop it or redevelop it in the future. And then that piece of property lived through September 11th and the great financial crisis. Tell us a little bit about your history with 50 West.
Okay. Actually, when I bought it, I wasn't thinking of redeveloping it. I was thinking of it more as an income property, and it was fully leased, and I think it made about a 10% return. So it looked like something I could just hold on to and over time watch rents go up and hopefully expenses keep stable and have growing income and growing value. In the 90s, we lost some tenants, and New York was just beginning to think about downtown as a mixed-use environment.
I mean, that was very non-residential back in the day, right?
Very non-residential, although Battery Park already existed. And there was something called the Giuliani Plan, which offered tax benefits if you converted commercial properties to residential. So we were actually started to convert part of the building and was, I think, one of the first properties to qualify under that plan. By 2005, we had maybe converted half the building, but there was a lot of major work that we needed to consider, and we realized that the siting of the building was such that if we demolished it and built a new building, there would be extraordinary views mm-hmm. available from the apartments. So we began to study that as an option.
And you spent a lot of money on architects just even thinking about this, right?
We spent, one of the surprises when you go into development is land is expensive. Well, preparing plans is very expensive. And we developed full plans for the building, which at that point was to be a hotel and a condominium apartment complex. But our plans got interrupted by the course of events in the financial world.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Here's a building that you're racing to meet the deadline for certain tax advantages. You've already built the foundation. You've sunk a lot of the main support beams, but you haven't started building the building itself. And then September 15th, 08, Lehman Brothers collapses into bankruptcy. And I think you were talking about a $500 million financing for the whole project from start to finish. What did the collapse of Lehman Brothers do to that development?
Well, I recognized almost immediately that building into that kind of financial environment would be disastrous. So I made the decision very quickly to pull the plug, halt development, and wait for a better day.
In other words, not actually give up the property, but, hey, let's postpone this project until credit frees up a bit.
Credit frees up, and credit is only one part of the equation. If it's for sale housing the way this was, mm-hmm. condominiums, there had to be a willing market to buy it, because otherwise you might have the financing, but you wouldn't have a way to pay it back.
Right. Makes sense. So, but that ran into a problem almost immediately, didn't it?
Yes, I had a little misunderstanding with a bank who had financed the foundation construction for me, even though I had told them what I was doing and they seemed to concur. All of a sudden in January, they sent me a letter saying I was in default because my loan required me to continue building no matter what. Mm-hmm. And of course, I called them and said, "Are you crazy?" Anyway, I don't really know what was going on. Within a couple of weeks, they backed off, mm-hmm. And we renegotiated the agreement to allow for the interim period that would be needed until the market was suitable, and both from a financing point of view as well as a buying point of view.
And how did the building ultimately turn out?
Well, it turned out very, very well.
One of the things that I found so fascinating in your book, Risk Game, was how razor-thin the margins were for building properties and the constant search for cash and financing. Is that a fair description of commercial real estate in the 1970s or generally?
Well, I would say generally. And it also depends on the nature of what you're developing. So if you are in a generic kind of marketplace with generic ideas, mm-hmm. Not surprisingly, competition is fierce and the margins are highly compressed.
When you say generic marketplace, what are you referring to?
Well, for example, New York City, mm-hmm. which for the last 10 or 15 years has been considered or one of the best investment markets in the world. So capital from everywhere, every corner of the world wants to be here. Mm-hmm. So there's fierce competition and cap rates get compressed. However, at the same time, if you go to other regions of the United States or internationally, you'll find a different picture. Market by market, submarket by submarket.
Very, very interesting. One of the things I thought was fascinating heading into the financial crisis was a similar situation where a lot of global money was looking for returns, Much of it found its way to New York real estate development. And I heard a lot of real estate deal lawyers complain, gee, the ROIs, the return on investments on all these projects seem to be getting more and more compressed. Is that a fair description of what you saw leading up to the 08 collapse?
Very much so, although I have to say that it's not only leading up to the 2008 collapse. It's prevalent in markets that are in great favor, really on a continuous basis. So
it's just that competitive.
You know, if you go to Toronto today, which is one of the biggest development markets in North America, and has been probably for 15 or 20 years, you'll find that the profit margins on development are around 12%. That's probably half of what it would be even in New York.
Really?
Yes.
That tight?
It's that tight.
So one of the things that was so surprising about the financial crisis from a real estate perspective, I have always thought of developers as being somewhat countercyclical and somewhat opportunistic. After a crash, they love to go looking for high-quality buildings and high-quality plots for development that have fallen on hard times and are much less expensive than they normally would be. And there seems to be a tendency of them throttling back as the economy begins to overheat and interest rates rise. I don't know if we really saw a lot of that in that, let's call it 01 to 08 cycle. Am I looking at it with a biased perspective, or was that unusual versus prior cycles where developers seem to be savvier? They seem to be the smart money.
Well, I think that it's not all developers, I think the world divides itself, and there is a tendency when the sun shines, when money's available, for many developers to move forward. There are other developers, and I can think of a couple in New York, for example, the Durst family, who were intergenerational and used to thinking over long periods of time. And I remember that in post the collapse of 2008, they started looking around and buying when nobody else was. So, of course, you also have to have very deep pockets,
right?
Because in these countercyclical times, banks are not necessarily willing participants. So often you either have to have very, very good banking relationships, or you have to be able to buy with your own resources on an all-cash basis and then hope to finance at a later time. So I think the vast part of the development crowd sort of follows the money. And then there's a group that's exceptional who are more countercyclical.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the innovation that is the cooperative. How did you come to recognize this legal structure as superior to others? And tell us a little bit about that development.
So you mentioned that I invented the co-op, which isn't true.
Okay.
The co-op existed long before I got involved in the
market. Is it better to say you popularized the co-op?
I did. What co-ops prior to when I got involved, which was in the late 70s, were really familiar at two ends of the spectrum. Either Park Avenue, very expensive apartments, were many of those were co-op buildings. Or, interestingly, there were some low-income or limited-profit co-ops that were created for people who could only afford really affordable housing done in co-op form. Those were done, some unions created that housing, some were government, and some were other not-for-profit groups. But in between, sort of middle-class housing, it was not yet popular. And I recognized that both buildings in the boroughs, for instance, a large complex that I undertook in Brooklyn and elsewhere, would be suitable for home ownership. And I also recognized that there were secondary buildings, some non-elevated, in very good locations in Manhattan, for instance, in Greenwich Village, mm-hmm. that would be very desirable and people would be interested in owning. So it was really seeing a broader market for co-ops as opposed to actually inventing the first one.
Your dad was a literary agent and worked with quite a few very famous authors. How did you find that business? What was that like?
Well, it was very much in my family and in my blood, so I grew up among publishers and writers.
Mm-hmm. And some pretty famous writers.
And some pretty famous writers.
Stephen King, James Patterson, Dan Brown, these are household names, aren't they?
Yeah, some of those came, well, after my father died, more during my tenure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they were very much part of my growing up and my consciousness.
How long did you actually work as an agent?
Well, I worked actively for about a decade, mm-hmm. Sort of 50-50 with my real estate activities, and then I cut back the agency work. I still own the agency today. Mm-hmm. It's probably 5% or less of my time.
So back then it seemed that authors did not really get a great deal out of the publishers. Was the business really all that lopsided back then? What was it like?
Well, I think publishing was evolving. Distribution of paperbacks mm-hmm. Was getting wider. Book club distribution was strengthening. So the revenues that a very successful author could command were growing. And you saw a leapfrogging of the value of brand name authors during that period.
So let me give you an example of something from your book that I found astonishing. Your office represented Stephen King, and his prior deals when you first brought him on limited his annual royalties to $10,000 a year. So even if he earned much more than that, it would get spread out over time. That seems like a terrible deal.
Well, I have to correct a couple of things.
Okay.
We only work with Stephen for a moment in time
mm-hmm.
because certain issues that came up in his mind regarding conflicts that he felt we had with other clients. But before we represented him, he was working directly with Doubleday.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 70s, theoretically, in a way to help authors, because we didn't have income averaging. So if you earned a lot of money one year, you'd pay a very high rate of income tax.
Right.
And if you earned less the next year, you couldn't balance the 2 years. I think later on in tax legislation, you could do that. But anyway, at that time, so publishers and authors created this sort of maximum earning concept that they put in contracts purportedly to help the authors. But what happened in Stephen King's case was that his earnings were so enormous mm-hmm. that what seemed like a reasonable annual amount initially became a 100-year payout for what the earnings were as a result of the success of his books.
And you did a couple of other very big books. I remember Bronx Zoo about the New York Yankees, and the G-Spot book just went berserk. That became a global bestseller. Tell us about that.
Well, I represented a psychologist, a popular psychologist from California, a man named George Bach.
Mm-hmm.
And he often stayed with me in New York when he was here, and he'd just come back from a sexology conference where the author of the G-Spot, Beverly Whipple, had made a presentation about her research and theories. And he said to me, "Look, Francis, you should get a hold of her, and she should write a book." So I said, okay, I never heard of the G-Spot. I decided that I felt it was more appropriate to have a woman agent in my office. pursue it with her, which she did, and we signed her up, and the rest is history.
And that sold just huge amounts in all around the world.
All around the world.
I have to go back to the 1970s, really, where you cut your teeth in real estate. What was it like trying to develop real estate when interest rates were double digit and there seemed to be a lot of impediments to getting anything done in New York City?
Well, in the early 80s, I was undertaking my first renovation. It was a building in Brooklyn Heights, actually. And I watched the prime rate soar all the way. I can't remember if it hit 18 or 19%, mm-hmm. but it was astronomic. And actually, it was an inverted yield curve, so the long rates were lower. You could borrow five-year money at about 14.75% mortgage money. And what we did in those days, the bank had a way that you could buy the rate down. You paid them a certain amount up front, so the homeowner would get a mortgage at 12.75%, which in that crazy environment seemed like a good rate.
Right.
And so that was how we went about selling some of our units. The rest we ended up renting and selling a few years later when the market stabilized.
So the regulatory environment, the sort of NIMBY thing that we still see today, the not in my backyard issue, was that a big problem in the 70s and 80s, or were people sort of open-minded about development is good, it's an economic increase, and it creates more housing?
Well, I think the people are flexible, but there is a NIMBY kind of mentality, particularly depending on the type of housing that's being created. We undertook to build a major project in Brooklyn, in downtown Brooklyn, and when I proudly told the borough president that we were including a major component of affordable housing, he said, "No way, not in that neighborhood."
Really?
And I couldn't believe my ears that this
politician
was not favoring affordable housing. He eventually overcame that because I explained that it was being co-sponsored by the Actors Fund, and that some of the people there would be formerly homeless people, mm-hmm. but some of the other people were going to be retired actors who were needed housing, and that somehow made it more politically acceptable.
Quite interesting. So in New York, we've seen a huge number of these very tall buildings going up. What do you think about the state of real estate, commercial real estate development today?
Well, I think in terms of for sale housing, the market is bifurcated.
Mm-hmm.
If it's housing that is at a low price point, which for New York City means below $3
million, right,
there's still a reasonably active market. The super luxury market has cooled off dramatically, and I would say that this is not a time that I would want to be building super luxury housing. And I think some of the projects that are sort of caught in the middle right now that are being built are going to have trouble selling their units.
So that space very much boomed for a while during the post-credit crisis recovery. It seemed it was scraping along and then it just exploded. Did we overbuild? Did the prices just get too silly? What seems to be the issue there? And those tend to be cash purchases, not mortgage properties.
Well, I think...
Especially in the higher end, is that fair?
No, I don't think that that's necessarily true.
Really?
I think it's mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe half cash, okay, and half financing. I think it was a confluence of events, which are often what occurs. And those events are a combination of increased supply,
mm-hmm.
A misperception of the depth of demand. So, you know, people see a few apartments or, 100 apartments being sold at a certain price point, and developers extrapolate that into being a market for 1,000 or 2,000. So often, under the market system, we really don't know when we've oversupplied the market till things stop selling.
That's how you know.
And the other factor, which I think is coming into play now, is that as a result of the tax legislation that was recently passed, New York and some other states that may be high service states but have to have high taxes to support them are in disfavor. And I'm sure that's in the minds of some wealthy people who are thinking of locating here.
We're talking about SALT, state and local tax deductions,
correct,
which got capped at a pretty low level, which is hurting New York, California, I would guess Chicago and Boston.
I think those are all on the list, and
right,
there are others.
Right. I also recall reading, you had referenced LLCs more easily buy condos versus co-ops in order to, in many ways, provide some degree of privacy for whoever the owner is. Are we still seeing a lot of LLC purchases of along those ways for those purposes? Or has there was a giant New York Times article a couple of years ago about this? Or has that trend kind of eased off?
Well, I think LLCs exist for two reasons. In some cases, it may be anonymity. Mm-hmm. But in other cases, it's a simple legal protection against personal liability.
Makes sense.
Many lawyers would advise their clients, regardless of whether they're concerned about their identity or not, to purchase through what's called a single-purpose LLC.
Mm-hmm. So liability to protect the household or liability to protect the owner in case there's an issue with
to protect
the household?
The owner. I mean, normally you have insurance, et cetera, but, you know, God forbid some very, very unexpected event occurs. If it's owned by an LLC, you would be protected, whereas if you owned it in your own name, you would be totally reliant on your insurance, which may be fully adequate, but a very cautious lawyer would recommend an LLC.
Time Equities, I know you focus a lot in Brooklyn and Manhattan. Are you outside of the New York area? Where else do you look to do some construction and renovation?
Well, actually, Time Equities is a very national and international company.
Mm-hmm.
We own property in 30 states. We own property in 6 countries, U.S., Canada, Germany, Holland, Italy, and one property in the Caribbean.
And let's talk a little about the real estate cycle. Where are we here? Is this late cycle, early cycle? It seems like there hasn't been a lot of supply coming to the market. There doesn't seem like a lot of existing homes have come up. How are you looking at where we are in that in that season?
Well, I think real estate is always in two cycles. One is its own cycle, supply and demand,
mm-hmm,
in a particular submarket. And the other is what's the financing market look like and what is the ability of purchasers or renters to consume additional real estate. I think the economy generally, bankers say we're in the 10th, now 11th inning of a 9-inning game.
Right.
And so we all sort of know that intuitively, and that's, of course, a concern. Different submarkets have different characteristics. We tend to be opportunistic, and we look for properties that are underperforming in a given market, and real estate tends to exist over long periods of time. So we don't think in 12, 24-month segments. We think in 5 and 10-year segments.
Mm-hmm.
So we could be in and out of a cycle within that period of time.
So the credit cycle you referenced, I've heard lots and lots of people complain that they had to jump through all sorts of hoops to get a mortgage. If we're in the 11th inning, we still seem to have fairly tight credit unless that's changed. How do you see us in terms of availability of credit, not necessarily price of credit, which is still pretty reasonable?
I think the credit markets are bifurcated, and when people refer to the problems of getting mortgages, they're usually talking about the market for home mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the regulators, the government, reacting to the last crisis, which seemed to enfranchise too many borrowers, became very, very restrictive. I remember, as perhaps you did, that I think it was Bernanke who couldn't get a mortgage himself.
Right.
In any case, in the commercial the financing of income properties, whatever their type, residential, office, industrial, the markets are pretty liquid. Although the market has maintained a decent discipline, there is more flexibility now in things like repayment terms. So we're seeing a lot of interest-only loans rather than self-amortizing or 10-year amortizing loans.
These are on the commercial development side?
On the commercial income property side, yes.
We have been speaking with Francis Greenberger. He is the founder of Time Equities, a real estate development company, both nationally and around the world. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and come back and check out the podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue discussing all things real estate. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
The problem is that money doesn't travel on the internet natively, and there's no standard for money to move natively, digitally, on the internet, globally, the way that it should.
This is David Marcus. David's the former president of PayPal and the current CEO of Lightspark, an internet payments operator.
It's insane. I mean, it's like literally moving money like it moved in the 70s.
Could cryptocurrency payments be about to catch on, becoming the digital standard? To make an educated guess about that, it turns out we need to look back to England in the 1600s, when paper money was invented in Europe. To explore more, listen to Evolving Money from Coinbase and Bloomberg Media Studios, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the podcast. Francis, thank you so much for doing this. I am a real estate junkie. I grew up in a household with a mom who was a real estate agent. It was always dinner table conversation. And I, as a person in finance, always paid close attention to what was going on in real estate. If you were looking in the right place, as much as so many people said the financial crisis came out of nowhere, if you were looking at the right part of the real estate market, there were tons and tons of warning that a freight train was coming down at the tracks at everybody. I just think most people weren't looking in those spaces.
We're talking 2008?
Sure.
I think it certainly took me by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it wasn't like most people who work in an industry, you may know a lot about your industry, but you don't necessarily know global finance as well as you might. I mean, we all take it into consideration, and the system was really a banking and finance problem as mm-hmm. opposed to a real estate problem,
for to say the least. The other thing that took me by surprise, we have a president today who comes out of the real estate development sector. I was surprised that the 2017 tax code basically punished places like New York City and New York State by capping the state and local taxes. That was kind of shocking to me. I figured if anyone wouldn't want to do that, it would be President Trump, but he signed off on that.
Well, I can tell you a funny story, Barry. Ronald Reagan made the same proposal in 1982, mm-hmm. and a number of the major New York real estate families led by Larry Tisch called an emergency meeting. They wanted to raise $2 million or $5 million overnight in order to fight the legislation that was being proposed, same salt kind of mm-hmm. Provisions. And I went to that meeting, and Trump was there. And I think people were kind of hemming and hawing, and I said, come on, a sidewalk costs us $100,000. Our whole portfolios are at risk here. And I immediately agreed to make a substantial contribution. And Trump was number two.
Mm-hmm.
And then the others fell in line. So we obviously had a very different point of view at that time. But if he has a good memory, he certainly knows that this is a pivotal issue that has existed over a long period of time. So, yes, I was very surprised to see him not appreciate the importance of what was involved.
It almost seems like it's a red state payback to the blue states for not voting for him. I don't know the thinking behind it. It certainly doesn't raise a whole lot of money for the federal government. It's relatively modest in the scheme of things. I guess the high tax, high service states somehow offend the low tax, low service states. That's my best guess for that.
Well, I think I have no particular knowledge. I think Trump has left the real estate world and obviously become totally devoted to his political activities and seems to have transferred all of his allegiances to the right-wing base, which he credits with his election.
I think he's probably right about that. So you mentioned that Time Equities has not only expanded to 30 states, but is now international. When did that begin? What was that process like?
I think even though America may think of Canada as an extension of the U.S., they don't. I can assure you of that. And that was my first international investment, which I think was in 1997.
You mentioned Toronto. Is that where it was?
No, it was actually in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Lovely city.
Lovely city. I'd been dealing with a broker who was based in Montreal on a U.S. transaction, which we completed. And he said, hey, you should come up here. There are some great buys, and it's very inexpensive. And I went up there. And I had he'd arranged a lunch with a bunch of developers, bankers, and it would seem very pleasant until we got to dessert, and then war broke out over the French-English separatism
in Montreal.
So then I realized what the problem was. And at that particular point in time, that would have been 96 or 97, pricing did not really reflect the problems that were going on. But by 97, 98, they did. And that's when I made my first purchase.
So in other words, that dual language mandate helped to drive real estate prices lower?
Well, it was a confluence of events. There was an extended recession, but certainly the fact that the Anglophiles, led by the Seagram family, had made a decision to pull out of Montreal was not a positive. And in fact, the first property I bought was from Seagram, from a Seagram's owned entity.
And what do you think of Montreal today?
You know, I think it's a fantastic city. I often say it's France and North America.
Right.
It's booming. It's got a great tech center sector. I think it's a wonderful place.
And some folks have said that Canada had come through the financial crisis without any of their banks blowing up. They have far fewer banks, a lot of concentration in the four or five largest banks, but a whole lot more regulation and a whole lot more oversight. The good news is their banks are all in pretty good shape. The bad news is a lot of people point at Canadian real estate as one of the bigger bubbles in the world. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's true that cap rates in Canada have compressed a great deal, and I haven't been able to buy any new income property there for five or more years. Mm-hmm. So I certainly agree that the market is very expensive. Does that mean it's a bubble? Maybe. I think the bubble that's referred to is sometimes a construction boom in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Toronto has traditionally absorbed 15,000 to 20,000 new units a year, which is extraordinary, and they've been doing it for almost 20 years.
They have that much immigration to the city?
They have that much immigration, both international as well as domestic. And people wonder, how long can this continue without some sort of a breather?
Since I started going to Vancouver for a conference about a decade ago, I just think that's a fantastic city. It's beautiful. The weather is nice. The people are nice. The architecture is great. It's right on the bay. Some people have described that as a China-induced bubble. A lot of folks out of China can get money out of the country to buy real estate, and the locals complain about these see-through towers. These brand-new buildings go up. They're fully sold. Nobody's living in them. What do you see is happening in Vancouver?
Well, the history of the largest development project that I know of in Vancouver was, of course, owned by Li Ka-shing, mm-hmm. who's perhaps the wealthiest person in Asia. I think he's Hong Kong-based. He also owns 10% of CIBC, one of Canada's largest banks.
Right.
So his presence, and he's legendary. He's the Warren Buffett of Asia, and certainly has a lot of investors and apartment owners who have followed him and who have bought the complexes that he's built there. And I haven't been there recently, but it's enormous. So there is a very close tie to China, to Asia, and of course it's convenient because you can fly there easily, being a West Coast city. And I can imagine that today, with the Chinese currency controls, that will affect the Vancouver market. In fact, I think I've read a little bit that it already has. But clearly, the ability of the Chinese to buy outside their market is being severely reduced and compromised at the moment.
So you mentioned you have investments in real estate outside of North America. Where are you putting money to work in either Europe or South America or Asia? What catches your fancy these days?
Well, my most recent, there were really two places that I would think about. First is Holland.
Mm-hmm.
Holland was at the end of a long recession about 2 or 3 years ago. Banks weren't lending. And a lot of the local real estate companies were very compromised by the losses that they took during a sustained recession. So real estate was very cheap in Holland, and nobody had the ability to execute on it and buy it. So we have bought about 25 or 30 office buildings there in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been an area of great activity to us, and we've set up a small asset management office. So we're very, very Netherlands-centric. In addition, we just made an investment in Italy,
mm-hmm.
which is working its way out of an enormous pile of debt and issues in a similar contrarian play.
Where in Italy?
Well, we bought what we did was we bought a portfolio of non-performing loans that it was controlled by a Tuscan bank. So most of the loans are in and around Tuscany.
Okay. There are worse places in the world to spend time. If you're looking at Italy, are you looking at any of the other Southern European countries that seem to fall on hard times over the past couple of years, Greece or Portugal or Spain?
Well, we spent time looking at Spain, but we found that the tradition, the customs of the market are less transparent there
mm-hmm.
than we were used to. And so We were thinking closely about it and had allied ourselves with some local groups, but nothing came of it. It's funny you mentioned Greece. We were having a discussion about Greece just the other day, and we'll take a look. Portugal is obviously a country that's very much on the rise and has a lot of very positive indicators. And I'd like to investigate it more, although I suspect the real estate there is already reflected the upturn in their economy.
I would imagine that making an investment overseas, whether it's Canada or Italy, is much more challenging than being in your own local backyard. How different are the legal rules? How different is the business culture? What do you encounter when you try and bring what you've done in the United States overseas?
Well, clearly, gaining a very, very careful understanding of the legal structure is important. Understanding the tax structure, And that's sort of the first steps that we take when we think about a country. We look, of course, at sovereign risk, but we look at the legal and tax structure. I remember going to Poland, mm-hmm. and a lawyer there was lecturing me on how Poland had special laws that non-Polish citizens couldn't own speculative real estate. And then he spent 2 hours explaining how to get around it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, I don't really like to get around things. If I'm not welcome here, thank you.
Right.
And I can then continue to concentrate on Germany, which certainly has lots of rules.
But it's pretty transparent.
It's transparent.
Right.
So you have to understand each market and study it and understand what you're getting into.
Not too long ago, I was sort of shocked at how relatively inexpensive Berlin was compared to the rest of Europe. Where are you investing in Germany?
Well, I started investing in Berlin in about 2003, 2004.
Wow.
And actually ran into a publishing friend when I was at a publishing convention in Frankfurt. And he said, you like real estate, go to Berlin. They're giving it away. And they were. So I bought as much as I could find that made sense in sort of the 2004 to 2010-12 period. But now the market, just like Canada, has become a very, very favored investment market. Mm-hmm. Prices have escalated, and we're not able to buy properties there at good spreads. We're happy to have the ones that we do, and they're very, very much more valuable than they were when we bought them.
And you guys, time equity is not much of a flipper. If you buy a property at a good price and it appreciates, but it's throwing off income, you would. My understanding is you prefer to hold on to those.
We're very cash flow oriented, so we sort of built our business based on having a very strong amount of cash flow. Because when you're in the flipping business or totally in the for sale business, you're a victim of markets, mm-hmm. and what do you do when the markets go south? If you're running an income business, a rental business, you know that there's going to be income there through thick and thin. It may vary to one degree or another, mm-hmm. But you're not going to suddenly have the tap go dry.
You speaking of taps, you mentioned the Dutch. I think most of Holland is below sea level, and they have some pretty extensive structural engineering to keep water out, even if we see sea level go up. There was a piece in the New York Times not too long ago about the threats to certain coastal cities in the United States, and that the insurance industry has been raising rates if you're anywhere near either a hurricane zone or a rising waters situation. How do you see the potential threat of rising ocean levels relative to real estate investing?
Well, it's certainly probably the greatest disruption that the business faces. We read every day, whether it's special sections in the New York Times or there was a report out this morning, and notwithstanding that politically the administration has decided that the problem doesn't exist or shouldn't be referred to, it's clearly a major problem and is coming, and it's coming quickly. Mm-hmm. At Time Equities, we've had a Department of Sustainability probably for 10 years, so it's certainly an issue that we pay attention to. It's not a simple one, and how you manage the risk in different situations requires a complex point of view. It's funny, I spent the summer talking to my wife about our house, our beach house on Long Island.
Right.
And do we sell it and move inland? What do we do? And of course, it's problematic because we enjoy being there, right. And our family members and friends do. But when do you pack your bags and run? It's complicated.
So if you were, that raises an interesting question. If you were shopping for a new beach house today, would you buy a place in, let's say, the beachfront in Miami or even the Hamptons? Is that something you would be reluctant to put a big investment into?
I would certainly be reluctant. Hmm. The problem is, of course, the place that I have is attached to a lot of memories.
Right.
We've had it for 20 years. The kids grew up there, and how do you separate from it? But
the problem with every real estate transaction is you just described it.
It's more than bricks and mortar.
Right. So I know I only have you for so much time, and I have a bunch of more questions to get to, including my favorite questions I ask all our guests. Why don't we jump right into those and see where they go? Tell us the most important thing that we don't know about you.
Well, although I am transparent and candid, I also know how to keep a secret and do. So,
tell us one.
No, thank you.
Talk to me about your early mentors. Who helped guide your career, be it in the literary agency space or in commercial real estate?
Well, I was blessed with several extraordinary mentors, and these names won't mean anything to listeners, but in the publishing business, someone who in the industry is regarded as a giant. It was a German publisher named Rowohlt, and he was almost like a second parent to me.
Mm-hmm.
In the real estate business, there were two people, Charlie Benenson, who is well known in the industry, and certainly had a major influence on me in all respects. And there was another man named Milton Newmark, who was a real estate lawyer, who also was a great mentor to me. Mentors are very, very important to me. I feel like I've learned more from them than I have in academic studying.
Makes some sense. What real estate developers, builders, investors influenced how you think about investing in the real estate space?
Well, my entire career, I always make an effort to listen to what other developers are doing, meet with them, read about them, and learn from them. However, in the end, you have to make your own choices and decisions, and I feel I do. It's informed by understanding the experience of others, but it's not determined by them.
Fair enough. Let's talk about some books. What do you enjoy reading? What are your favorite books, be they real estate, non-real estate, fiction, nonfiction?
Well, I'm an avid reader. Sometimes I'm reading about real estate. Sometimes I'm reading about history, biography. I think non-real estate, recent book that is now shockingly in my mind on the bestseller list, I think it's number one, is Sapiens. Mm-hmm. Which is a history of mankind, just shows you that there are an extraordinary number of sophisticated readers, a remarkable literary work and a remarkable history of mankind. But I, in real estate, it's been a few months, I read Sam Zell's new book,
mm-hmm.
And thought that there were a number of interesting insights in it. I also read a book, came out a few, maybe a year ago, about all the development that Zeckendorf did in New York that I thought was extraordinarily good and an interesting history of New York real estate.
The Sam Zell book is Am I Being Too Subtle? Is that the one?
Exactly.
And what is the Zeckendorf for? Developing My Life.
Developing My Life, exactly.
That's it.
Exactly.
Huh.
Terrific book. And it talks not only about Zeckendorf himself, but about the whole era in which he was such a dominant figure.
So you bring so much of a publishing background to your personal reading. Are you ever halfway through a book and you say, I wish I would have found this book? Or the opposite, who the hell published this crap? This is terrible. How does your background affect what you read?
Well, I mean, I do look at who publishes books, and to some degree, it can inform the quality of it,
mm-hmm.
but it's certainly not the sole criteria, but sort of interesting to me. Just like if I look at a building, I'm interested to know who developed it.
Right. Huh.
I should also, of course, I left it out. I also read continuously the books that my literary agency produces, of course, I read Dan Brown's book the second it arrives, mm-hmm. And many of our other clients.
Who else? Let me give you an opportunity for some shameless promotion of your current client roster. Who is do you find especially readable, compelling, fascinating?
Well, I'd be concerned about.
I don't want you to offend any of the
ones. Here, I'll tell you a cute story. I got a new children's book the other day, mm-hmm. and there is a there's an agent in our office who is a in addition to being an agent, she also writes books herself. And I didn't realize that it was so prolific, that she was so prolific. But if I understand what I got the other day, it's her 50th book.
Wow.
So she's both a very, very successful literary agent, but also writes at midnight, I guess, and has produced an incredible library of her own work.
50, that's a lot. Although kids' books don't have a whole lot of text, so maybe it's...
I'm granted they were shorter books.
So let's talk about real estate. What are you excited about these days in the commercial real estate area?
Well, I'm excited about tilting our portfolio to a Europe-centric one. Both our presence in Holland and now in Italy and exploring new places is something that that interests me a great deal. The other thing in my career, I spent half of it or more renovating half the world, but I hadn't done a lot of new development or new construction. Starting around 20 years ago or 20 or 25 years ago, I got involved in new construction. And I find that very challenging and very interesting. So I'm happy to be engaged in doing that, and it's exciting to me.
Is it a different experience starting with a clean sheet presentation by an architect as opposed to here's the existing structure, here's what we have to work around? They sound like two very different experiences.
They're completely different. In one case, you're correcting the mistakes that somebody made. In the other case, you're making your own mistakes.
So what do you think is changing the most in commercial real estate? What is going to be very different 20 years from now than what developers are experiencing today?
Well, I think as we were talking when we came in, the nature of the workplace as well as the nature of where people live have moved beyond programmatic needs, mm-hmm. moved beyond space that you need for your work or for your living, and we're very much involved in what we call experiential moments. Mm-hmm. How is the space experienced? What is the user experience? What do they want to encounter? And we're seeing dramatic changes in that people want amenitized spaces where they can work in a different way, as you were commenting as we were walking in on about Bloomberg's offices.
Right. You come into this building, all the elevators take you to the sixth floor, which becomes the general lobby. And the thinking behind that is you just end up with these serendipitous interactions with people that you may not otherwise see if everybody just takes an elevator up to their own floor. And the whole idea of having a food space and it's a different design philosophy, and I like your use of the word experiential. It really is what it is. It's not just physical space. Someone has thought about flow and how people interact in the real world.
And these days, when we're retrofitting suburban office buildings, which we do a lot, or urban ones for that matter, we're now introducing major amenity lounge spaces, co-working spaces, wellness spaces, and food and beverage spaces. So they almost become a little hotel-like beyond the typical office situation.
That's pretty interesting. So this is always an interesting question, and I kind of have a sense of where you're going to go with this from your book. Tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
Well, I fail all the time. I always say that I don't bat 1,000. I bat 650. But that's pretty good. So I think I think recently, I don't know whether it was Bezos or somebody said, if you haven't failed continuously, you're not making progress.
Right.
I have many, many mistakes or many issues that we deal with. And I think when a business plan goes wrong, the important thing is to switch strategies quickly and either find a way to minimize your losses, or if it's a market correction that you're subject to, perhaps putting it, extending the business plan time frame until markets recover, which, for instance, if it's a for sale project, going into a rental mode would be a way to do that.
Hmm. What do you do for fun outside of the world of real estate?
I'm a big traveler. I like new places. Going to Copenhagen next week for the first time.
Careful of the bicycles. It's a fascinating city.
Well, I spent a lot of time in Amsterdam.
Okay.
No place that's more bicycle dangerous than Amsterdam.
I have not been to Amsterdam, but I've been to Copenhagen. And even as many bikes are now in New York, it's just astonishing.
You really have to know the rules of the road, mm-hmm. and basically know that there may not be any rules, so just watch out.
My rule is get out of their way.
I love my family like everybody does. I love my friends. I spend a lot of social time. And I'm also a tennis player and a skier.
Hmm. Interesting. If you had a millennial or a recent college grad come to you and say they were interested in a career in commercial real estate, what sort of advice would you give them?
I would tell them to learn as much as they can, of course. I would tell them to learn how to differentiate themselves and to try to see things that others don't, because that's really, as we discussed earlier, where the margins are. If you think like everybody else, margins are thin.
And our final question, what is it that you know about the world of real estate today that you wish you knew 30 or 40 years ago when you were really ramping up?
Well, I've always had a sort of creative side, a visual sensitivity. But as I've gotten more and more into development, I realize that I really do have a very keen architectural sense.
Mm-hmm.
And development is teamwork. It's team between an architect and a developer. And if you bring that skill, that way to see into things and to appreciate good architecture and also redirect architecture when it goes awry or it's not serving your program, that's a very beneficial relationship. Mm-hmm. And I've enjoyed my working with a number of fantastic architects, including some of the best architects of the world. So that element of creativity is something that I discovered a little later in my career and would have perhaps liked to have done sooner.
We have been speaking with Francis Greenberger. He is the founder of Time Equities, an international real estate development firm. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look Up an Inch or Down an Inch on Apple iTunes, Bloomberg.com, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever finer podcasts are sold. And you can see any of the previous 225 or so such conversations we've had. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put together these conversations each week. Medina Parwana is my producer. Taylor Riggs is our booker. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Michael Batnick is our head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.